You're listening to Tech Tank, a bi-weekly podcast from the Brookings Institution exploring the most consequential technology issues of our time. From racial bias in algorithms to the future of work, Tech Tank takes big ideas and makes them accessible.
Thanks for joining our Brookings Tech Tank podcast. I'm Darrell West, a senior fellow in the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. For the first time in more than 50 years, the United States has put a lander on the moon. Although the Intuitive Machines vehicle tipped over after landing, the mission signifies renewed interest in exploring the moon as well as Mars, and perhaps an exciting new chapter for space discovery. Private companies are joining NASA in a big push to get back on the moon and beyond. To discuss the prospects, we're pleased to be joined by a distinguished expert. Marina Korn is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She writes regularly at that magazine and has a recent article entitled, Apollo's Sequel Will Be a Gold Rush. Marina, welcome to our Brookings Tech Tank podcast.
Hi, Darrell. Thanks for having me.
So you are a long-term observer of the space program and have written a number of tremendous articles over the year. Let me just start with a more personal question. How did you get interested in space?
Yeah, so I don't have a science background myself. Like many journalists, I was an English major. But my interest comes from my dad, who is a huge space nerd. He is the kind of person who, you know, if you were at a museum together, he could walk up to a meteorite on display, explain to you what you're looking at, and then you check the plaque and you realize, oh, that's exactly what he just said. You know, after college, like many millennials, I moved back home while I looked for journalism jobs, and my dad and I would watch space shows every night. So I've always just been fascinated by the wonders of the universe, you know, the solar system and well beyond. And so I got very lucky when I joined the science desk at The Atlantic and was told that my beat was the universe and to have at it. So it doesn't sound like a real job to be a space reporter, but it's a lot of fun.
That is a great beat, and you certainly have done many terrific articles over the years, and I'm sure many of our listeners have read the things that you have been writing. And I remember back in 1969 listening to that original moon landing and just having this sense of awe that humans were on the moon for the first time. So that kind of sparked my interest in this topic. And I know in your recent Atlantic article, you say Apollo's sequel will be a gold rush. What is the gold rush, and will the sequel be better than the original production?
Yeah, so the latest mission to land on the moon that you mentioned, this American-made lander from Intuitive Machines, that is just one attempt of many that have already been made in the last decade and many more to come. And so what we're seeing now is a flurry of moon activity that actually rivals the 1960s. You have NASA mounting the Artemis program, which is, you know, their attempt to return astronauts to the surface of the moon for the first time since 1972. And this time build a more sustained presence, you know, instead of shorter visits. You know, we're not talking cities, but some type of outposts, longer stays than just a few days or a week. And so many other companies and governments are involved. You know, if you think about the space race as, you know, two very competitive, sleek, talented runners running along the track to the same finish line, right now that track is filled with all kinds of participants, private companies and also national governments. And, you know, for the governments, landing on the moon still holds a certain cachet, and so it is still a signal of your, you know, national capability and power. So that is why countries like India have focused on doing that. China, that's very big for them. Like, landing on the moon still counts, even though, you know, we've been there, done that, you can say. It still very much counts and helps countries establish themselves as spacefaring powers to really be, you know, respected. As for the private companies, there's some business elements driving a lot of this momentum. Scientists believe that there is a lot of water on the moon, actually, that is stored in the form of ice, especially in the near the South Pole. And that's exciting to people because you can do all sorts of things with water, right? You can pour it into life support systems, or you can break down H2O and use those elements to create rocket fuel. So there, the idea of a lunar economy right now sounds a bit science fiction-y, but it could happen based on how much of this water ice is actually discovered at the lunar South Pole.
No, I think that is a great point. Where there is water, there are all sorts of possibilities for human activity. And I think you're right to highlight that region of the South Pole as a special object of interest on the part of many different countries. And it is impressive the number of countries that are now having space programs, having moon launches, and doing other sorts of things. And I think it really suggests this is the cusp of a new era of exploration that's probably going to yield very important results. You mentioned the role of private companies, and I'm just curious how you feel about private companies in space exploration. So I grew up in an era where NASA had a monopoly on space. So what should we make of SpaceX, Blue Origin, Intuitive Machines, and all of the other businesses that are launching vehicles into space?
Yeah, that is a great question. And sometimes when I've talked to people who are, at The Atlantic, our readers are very general interest readers, and a lot of people out there probably have never heard of the Artemis program, right? So when you tell them, oh, well, SpaceX and Blue Origin, they're really getting involved. I've heard some people say, well, shouldn't NASA be doing this? What are these companies doing here? But the reality is that NASA has invested in these companies to develop their vehicles, to launch payloads to the moon. Intuitive Machines, for example, is just one of 14 companies that NASA has hired to practice landing on the moon, to put payloads on the surface as a precursor to eventually putting people down. So there is no American space program today without these companies. And there, that was true to an extent in the 1960s too, right? NASA relied on the private sector for a lot of its contracts, a lot of its hardware. It's definitely more apparent now. Definitely because these companies are run by eccentric, sometimes very loud billionaires. It's a lot more in your face. But the reality is that, the American space effort really does depend on these companies, especially SpaceX. Right now, the only way for NASA astronauts to reach the International Space Station is on a SpaceX vehicle. The latest crew to the space station launched just 2 days ago. What's interesting is that in the last few years, there have been key human spaceflight officials at NASA taking jobs at SpaceX. So there's been a lot of mixing, SpaceX in particular is a really, really important contractor for NASA, almost as important as Boeing, for example. So, NASA itself is still definitely unmatched when it comes to building and dispatching robotic missions to, different planets in the solar system. Telescopes, for example, the James Webb Space Telescope, huge, huge effort. But a lot of those missions are launching on SpaceX rockets. For example, there's a mission later this year that I'm really excited about to Europa, which is a moon of Jupiter. And it's going to, kind of sniff out the conditions there to see if maybe there's, some building blocks for potentially microbial life. Super exciting mission, and it's launching on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy. So these private companies are everywhere now.
Yeah, I'm very excited about the Europa mission as well, because even though Europa is covered in ice, there seems to be some indication there actually could be liquid water underneath the ice. And of course, where there's water, there also could be microbial life. So if you have water plus energy, sometimes that has been a winning formula. So it will be interesting to see what comes out of that particular mission. The United States, of course, is not alone in sending vehicles to the moon. As you mentioned earlier, we're also seeing launches by China, Japan, Israel, India, and the UAE. Is all this international activity good for space exploration? Are we going to end up seeing a moon that at some point in the future is broken down into sovereign terrains the way we have on planet Earth?
Yeah, so this is such an interesting question because no one owns the moon, right? You know, a lot of space use and lunar activity is governed by, as you might know, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which some space lawyers might argue needs a little bit of updating. But right now, the moon is a bit of a free-for-all. For example, I think China is planning to land on the far side of the moon and return samples from that region back to Earth. And no spacecraft has ever landed on the far side of the moon. It would be a huge, huge accomplishment. So right now, the moon is kind of a proving ground for different countries and companies to show off what they can do. Whether all of this activity is good for space or not, I'm not sure if I'd want to put like a value judgment on it. But I think it's more interesting that we, and by we here I mean humankind, seems to have decided that space travel is just something that we do as a species. Once we did it, you know, in 1969 and beyond into the early 70s, why would we ever stop putting people in space? And so that's why, you know, NASA's trying to do that. China wants to put people on the moon. Russia does too, although their space program is a whole other story and not as powerful or resourced as it used to be. I think space travel is now just a mark of an advanced civilization, even though there are many earthly problems that probably people wish we spent more time on. Exploration is kind of this background hum that we've accepted, you know, that we will do because we've done it before. And what else would a technologically advanced civilization do, right? And if you have to go somewhere, why not go to the moon? It's a 3-day trip. It's nearby, still hard to land on it, as we've seen, but it's a good place to go as any.
Yeah, I do want to ask you about public opinion on the space program, because we can certainly see the excitement building over the various activities that are taking place in a number of different countries around the world. But I'm curious about how ordinary Americans in particular feel about space. Why should ordinary people be interested in space exploration? I mean, there have been some surveys showing that people think we should focus on Earth priorities as opposed to things that are taking place in outer space. Why should ordinary people be interested in and supportive of this?
Yeah, and this is the part where I hope my editors don't hear this and this gets me fired, but I'm not sure that I would say that people should be interested in space exploration. I'll tell you why. A few years ago, I spoke with the former director of the Hubble Space Telescope, Bob Williams, and he is the one that was responsible for that really gorgeous, beautiful Hubble deep field. He decided to use his discretionary time as director on the space telescope to just aim the instrument into nothing for hours. He just felt in his gut that he would see something, and he did, you know, thousands of beautiful glittering galaxies. And what Bob Williams told me is that, you know, people don't really need astronomy, for example, right? It's not an applied science. But he said that he believed that our lives would be poorer if we didn't have something like Hubble, something like astronomical discoveries, because to him, astronomy was like music. And I think we could all agree that our lives would be poorer without music. Now, space exploration and human space travel is a little different because, you know, as you know, many of the technologies that we depend on today, such as GPS and medical imaging, a lot of that did arise from the advancements of the Apollo era. And certainly, I think new technologies will emerge from the current era that we're in, the Artemis generation, as NASA calls it. But I'm not sure that reminding people that they owe Google Maps to the space program is entirely compelling enough to get them to care right now. It's more of a fun fact to the average person. But I do think that space exploration and travel is more like music, like how the Hubble director put it. You know, it can be really awe-inspiring and perspective-shifting if you take some time to sit with it and really think about what it means on a grander scheme and not just, you know, on the scale of our daily lives.
I do think thinking about a space does elevate all of our imagination. It kind of gets us beyond our own individual worlds, problems on planet Earth, to think about much bigger things, which I think is good for people everywhere. But I think you're also right. There have been a lot of commercial spinoffs from the space program. So I hope that people gain an appreciation both of the scientific as well as the financial benefits that have come out of the space program. Now, it's interesting, we've mainly been talking about exploring the moon, but of course we know there also is a lot of interest in Mars. It takes longer to get there, but there are exciting things taking place there as well. NASA would like to have humans on the red planet in the not-too-distant future. Elon Musk has talked about building a space colony on Mars. Why is there so much interest in Mars, and what do we hope to learn from exploring it?
Yeah, I mean, Mars has captivated people's imaginations for centuries, right? It was actually in the Atlantic, it was called the Atlantic Monthly then, in the 1890s that the astronomer Percival Lowell wrote a bunch of stories about the Martian canals that he believed he saw on the surface of Mars and that he thought could be, you know, home to intelligent life on the planet. Of course, that did not turn out to be the case. Once NASA started sending spacecraft missions to Mars in the 1970s, but Mars still holds that really special place for us. And I think, you know, it's an exciting next step, right? If you've gone to the moon and Apollo astronauts drove on the moon, they did all kinds of things on the moon. Like, you've kind of cornered that a little bit, and you want to see, okay, well, what can people do on Mars? Because that does have a walkable surface. It does have an environment that we could technically survive in with the right systems, the right domes and habitats, the right helmets. You know, if you believe that the human species should extend itself deeper into the solar system, Mars is the next obvious place to go. And obviously there's so much, you know, media and pop culture out there. I've lost count of how many space movies Matt Damon has been in. Definitely a few of them have to be about Mars, but it seems like the next logical step in our evolution as a spacefaring species.
And of course, we should also keep in mind that scientists have found evidence of flowing water on Mars from billions of years ago. Like, all of the indications of smooth pebbles and kind of areas that seem to feed into riverbeds are in evidence on Mars. And so, you know, it's just such an interesting story. Like, at some point, Mars may have been like the current Earth, of having water. And then the question is, were there other things that came along with that water, microbial life or otherwise? So I think scientists are really intrigued by just the possibilities of learning more about the science part of that. I'm curious, what timeline do you envision for a human mission to Mars? And what are the obstacles that we need to overcome in order to have that kind of successful mission?
Yeah, the short answer is don't mark your calendars just yet. The spaceflight community is really governed by a culture of optimism, I would say, which is both good and bad. You know, it's very good to set ambitious timelines and give people a clear-cut goal to work toward, to rush toward. But at the same time, really big space projects are usually always behind schedule. You know, for example, the James Webb Space Telescope launched many years behind schedule. You know, it's gorgeous, beautifully deployed, sending home gorgeous pictures, but it took a while to get up there. And there were concerns about budgets and fears of cancellation. And the same will be true for the Artemis program to the moon and any program that NASA decides to really, really go for Mars. Space travel takes a really long time, testing rockets and capsules and even building spacesuits. All of that takes a really, really long time. So NASA has had this goal of, you know, 2030s for a while now, but in my conversations with, former NASA officials, people that have worked on Mars programs, they don't expect astronauts to actually touch down on the surface until potentially the 2060s. So not anytime soon. I think definitely in this century, and it'll be really exciting when that happens. I think it will really capture the collective imagination in the way that the Apollo landing did, but not anytime soon.
I hope we can land there before the 2060s, but I think you're right. There are many technical barriers and just other types of logistical considerations. We know space travel to Mars is going to be much more challenging because it takes a lot longer to get there. And so therefore, the travelers are going to be exposed to much greater radiation. We know that if they actually land on the Mars, there are all these incredible dust storms that can be very problematic. I'm just curious, what do you see as the major obstacles to any type of mission to Mars?
I think radiation, which you just mentioned, is huge. The people who spend 6 months or a year on the International Space Station, they are aware that doing so increases their risk of cancer in some way. And that risk is so much higher if you're spending 6 to 9 months traveling to Mars. So we're going to have to build certain systems and hardware to really, really protect those travelers from that cosmic radiation. I think it also depends, on what kind of mission you want to do, whether you're NASA or Elon Musk. But the reality is that those two players are definitely going to go to Mars together. Just looking at how woven into the American space program SpaceX already is, countries have landed on Mars, but no one has ever launched off of the planet. So you have to determine whether, the people you're sending there, how are they going to come back? And so NASA does have this very ambitious program called the Mars Sample Return Mission that is running into some budget trouble right now, that would test that capability of launching something off of Mars and sending it back to Earth. But no one's ever done that before, and who knows if it'll work. And you need to figure out if it's going to work with human beings as your cargo before you can think about bringing them home. The idea, if you're sending people to Mars, you're going to be sending lots of smaller missions full of life support systems, supplies, all kinds of cargo ahead of them so that when people get there, they can really start setting up. But it's hard to imagine because, again, we as Americans are still trying to land on the moon again. So it all feels very, very distant future to me. And there's a lot more challenges that I think are going to crop up the closer we get to this goal.
And I think a lot of people don't fully appreciate how difficult it is to land on Mars. I mean, I think what the gravity there is something like, 1/8 of what we have on planet Earth. So just, everything we know about the dynamics of flight and landing on another planet and then taking off from that planet has to be changed just given the differences in the atmospheres, the differences in gravity and so on. So certainly that will be a big complicating factor.
Oh, I just thought of another complicating factor is that there's a communications delay between Earth and Mars. So, if you have people on the moon, you can talk to them the way you would, talk to them if they were, in the next room. But on Mars, there's a delay. And so it's going to be interesting to see, decision-making play out. Because let's say some type of emergency happens on Mars and those people are obviously going to be very well-trained, but if they need to talk to mission control, they have to wait. So they're going to have to be much more independent as astronaut crews have been at any other point in history. And NASA and other organizations are kind of testing this right now with various simulations where they put, a couple of people in a Mars habitat in a desert somewhere and see how they interact with each other. Interpersonal relations are also, that's also going to be a really, really huge challenge for a Mars mission because you have to make sure number one, that the elements don't kill people, but also that the people don't kill people, because if you are stuck in a capsule together for that long, you know, people are going to get on each other's nerves. And crew composition and the way they gel together is extremely important to the success of any type of mission.
Well, I hope they do very serious personality tests before they put anyone into those capsules, because you're right. Being trapped in a very small space with the same set of two, three, or four people for such a long period of time certainly is going to be aggravating. It's going to be irritating. And we have to make sure people can survive one another on that type of trip. I'm just curious. There, you know, there is a lot of talk, not just about exploring Mars, but at some point, probably in the much more distant future, having human colonies on Mars. I'm just curious your view on this. Like, is this realistic? Is this feasible? Is this something that actually might happen in the future?
Yeah, I'm always nervous about making too many predictions this far out, because if you look at the space industry right now, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago, people in the community would have laughed if you said, oh, well, the only way to get into space is on a SpaceX capsule, right? They wouldn't think that SpaceX was capable of launching humans into space. But I do think it is possible at some point. The reality is that space travel is dangerous and perilous. And so I hate to think about the loss of life that could occur as people try to establish homes on Mars. But, you know, the American space program has lost astronauts in its efforts to put people on the moon and even, you know, to be in low Earth orbit. The shuttle disasters, for example, I think it would be an extremely difficult undertaking with a lot of risks. I personally would love to see something like that, because I often talked to a space historian who was there for the launch of Apollo 11 in 1969. And in many ways, I want to be like him. I want to be talking about the Artemis moon landing or the Mars landing to younger generations. You know, what was it like then? And but a lot can happen in 10, 20, even 30 years. And so I don't know. I don't want to make predictions and then someone will dig up this podcast and say, oh, look at how wrong she was. But I do believe that once people have decided that space exploration is something that they want to do, they're going to keep doing it. And they're going to go deeper into the solar system to do that.
So as we think about the future, what are your hopes for the future of space exploration?
Would love to see a moon landing in this lifetime, and feel what you felt, Daryl, listening to the news reports coming out of that triumphant moment. I mean, I hate to sound so negative, but I do hope that as national governments and private companies push deeper away into the solar system and away from Earth, that they're very, very careful about what they're doing. Because like I said, people can die. And, you know, the space vehicles have a really good safety record until they don't. You know, the news of a crew launching to the ISS isn't really news anymore. You don't see too many headlines about it. And so it feels to the public like it's routine. But space travel was never routine. So I would hope that there is no significant loss of life, which I know is really depressing to think about, but it's the reality. And I do hope that, you know, I'd love to see, you know, an Artemis moon landing would be so exciting, I think, to the public in a way that maybe the Apollo 11 landing wasn't, you know, in the way that we have much better cameras now, and we will have such more beautiful views of the lunar surface. And I think that will really reacquaint us with the moon, to be able to see it in a really clear, high resolution way. I do think that people today are quite spoiled with special effects in Hollywood. Like, you know, maybe some people won't be impressed by the imagery that comes out of the lunar surface or the Martian surface. But knowing that it would be taken by people, I think is a really special thing. And so I hope that there are someday, you know, actually people on these worlds, on these planets, sending pictures home. You know, all of these people are extensions of the everyone else on the ground. And so I think that would be really special.
I do have to admit those television images in 1969 were pretty blurry and grainy. So I would definitely look forward to their high-resolution equivalents today. And I think that would excite people in a different sort of way than what we had with the Apollo mission. So my last question for you is, any advice that you have for U.S. policymakers on our space program? I know you've written extensively on this topic. You've been following various aspects of the space program for a number of years. Are there things they should be doing? Are there mistakes that they're making? Just curious if you have any general advice for them.
Yeah. Stop setting overly ambitious deadlines. And this is advice maybe for, you know, policymakers outside of Congress and maybe in the White House. If you recall when former President Donald Trump was elected to the White House, he gave NASA a really ambitious goal of putting people on the moon by 2024. It is 2024 now. That has not happened. NASA has pushed that deadline out a little bit further. Again, I think if policymakers can lead with realism and not legacy setting, that'll be better for NASA, right? Like, NASA especially has always been at the mercy of political will and budgets and shifting White House occupants. And that's not really a good way to run the world's most premier space agency, because space travel plays out on scales of decades, on centuries, right? If you send, the Europa Clipper, for example, that's launching hopefully at the end of this year, won't arrive at Jupiter until 2030, right? Who, you know, what will the country look like then? What will leadership look like then? You know, these missions will always outlast presidencies and congressional terms. So being able to plan ahead with those scales in mind, I think is better than just throwing out a date that you want to land on the moon.
Well, that sounds like terrific advice to me. NASA should do a better job on playing the expectations game, and they need to plan ahead much more effectively than it sounds like they sometimes do now. So this is a fascinating topic. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I want to thank Marina for sharing her thoughts with us today. At Brookings, we write regularly about digital technology and space policy, and you can find more information on our Brookings Tech Tank blog located at brookings.edu. So thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to Tech Tank, a series of roundtable discussions and interviews with technology experts and policymakers. For more conversations like this, subscribe to the podcast. And sign up to receive the Tech Tank newsletter for more research and analysis from the Center for Technology Innovation at Brookings.